just again as a way of review, Muhammad, born to probably lower middle class family, was not in poverty, but certainly was not well-to-do. He was part of a lowering branch of the ruling Quraysh tribe. That's going to be brought up again today, so that context is important. The pagan practice of Middle Eastern religion, it's not necessarily something that people follow religiously, but it is something that people just do out of traditional practice. So this pagan religion is generations old, you know, going all the way back to before the time of Christ. This area in Saudi Arabia is practicing this polytheistic religion, and they're worshiping at the Kaaba, and that's sort of the centerpiece of where Muhammad is operating. So he doesn't like this pagan religion, goes to the caves to meditate. This is where he receives his first visions and begins to convert those in Mecca from his friends and from additional people that begin to identify with his teachings. And his teachings are based pretty loosely on the teachings of Judaism and Christianity, not really following very accurately those teachings, but you can just kind of see his very minimal exposure to those religions, living in Mecca, which is a trade center of that portion of Saudi Arabia. He interacts with Christians, interacts with Jews, and then he just kind of pieces it together into his own brand of religion, which is now presenting himself as the final prophet of Judaism, Christianity, and now Islam. So a lot of evolving revelations that just sort of conveniently come to him as Islam evolves. With a hijra, he is convinced by a couple of pagan tribes from Yathrib, which becomes known as Medina, which is translated as the city of the prophet. He goes to Medina. Things do not really go as he plans. He's not able to work very well as a mediator right away. And so this brings about a lot of different issues. One of those issues is, of course, trying to remedy the relationship between these pagan tribes and the Jewish tribes that share the oasis with them. And so now you have these hundreds of Muslim immigrants who have left Mecca and moved to Medina, and now what are they going to do? They come from a trade background. They're all merchants. They do not farm. The Jewish tribes, for the most part, own a lot of the agricultural land around there, and so then we have conflict there as well. Because of their merchant backgrounds and their need for sustenance and jobs and their, you know, sort of innate nature to gain wealth and wanting to succeed, now we begin to discuss the violence in this religion as Muhammad gives permission to raid caravans that are bound for Mecca, which of course is going to turn the Meccans against those emigrant Muslims, which are in Medina. And I talked about how, from a Muslim point of view, they are fighting in defense, and we would more likely identify with those defending themselves from an aggressor as opposed to the aggressor. But in this case, historically, it seems a little bit more far-fetched to say that the Meccan armies would travel hundreds of miles north simply because they didn't like Muhammad. They had never tried to kill him when he lived in Mecca. They just didn't really like him because they thought his teaching of religion was going to take from all of the money they were getting from the pilgrimages to the pagan Kaaba. And so what really prompts people that didn't want to kill him before to now all of a sudden march their armies hundreds of miles through the Saudi desert to just up and attack him? It seems much more likely that the raids on the caravans were what prompted the Meccan's response. So in my sort of historical mind, I am viewing Muhammad and the Ummah, which U-M-M-A-H, that's the collection of Muslims, they're most likely the aggressors in this situation. They're the ones that are instigating the violence by raiding the caravans. Now you could sort of play the, you know, whose fault is it game and say, well, you know, the Meccans are the ones that forced him out of Mecca in the first place, and that's why he's in Medina, so they were persecuting him, and so then they're still the aggressors, and that's why he was attacking the caravans. But if we're talking about actual warfare, who strikes who gets first blood, then it's probably going to be Muhammad and not the Meccans. So now we are here talking about the warfare of Muhammad against these Meccans and what prompts those battles. So two major battles, Badr and Uhud, and the attacks on the caravans, they threaten the financial success of Mecca in a way that actually pretty closely resembles the way that Muhammad was threatening the financial success of Mecca when he was still living there. Okay, so this is the second time that Muhammad has attacked from an economic standpoint the culture and the people of Mecca, because first he's trying to dissuade people from being pagan. Okay? And if you convert to Islam, are you still going to go on these hundreds of miles or maybe even longer pilgrimages to the Kaaba in Mecca to worship as a pagan if you're converted to Islam? No. Okay, so then the Meccans are not making money off of these pilgrimages. Now he's raiding the caravans, and that is the direct economic lifeline of a city like Mecca. And so there's going to have to be retribution, because the Meccans cannot just sit back and let their caravans continue to be attacked to lose all of this money. Of course, Muhammad is not just raiding the caravans for on principle, and then letting the people go and saying you can still have your stuff. Just know that the Muslims are in Medina, and this is what we stand for. It's nothing like that. He's raiding the caravans, people taking all of the booty from those long caravans. I mean, you guys, if you think about just sort of historically ancient Middle East, and we kind of picture these long caravans of camels and horses and just the massive amount of wealth, that's how you got wealth from one place to another back during this time. And if you have somebody who's raiding these and taking all of that money, then you're going to have some sort of serious response, or else you're going to lose everything. So the first sort of major organized encounter between Muhammad's Ummah and the Meccans is the Battle of Badr. Okay. I like this quote. I'm probably going to use it for a lot of other things. That comes out of the Concise History of the Middle East. Nothing succeeds like success, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at a situation that may not go exactly how you plan it, but you sort of stumble into success anyway. And it doesn't really matter how you got there, but you succeeded, and nothing succeeds like success. So as long as you're doing, you end up on top of whatever conflict, it's okay. You'll figure it out. So what happens to prompt this attack, of course, is Muhammad's raiding of the caravans. And Muhammad sort of, in this part of his life, begins to present himself as a pretty capable military leader. Which is sort of odd, because he doesn't really, in his family, we don't find really any formal military training that he would have gotten. And really no political leadership either. So here he is, he founds this religion, and then these tribes come to him and say, come to Medina and be essentially the leader of our town so that we can remedy all these issues that we have. So now he's a political leader, and now all of a sudden he's a military leader as well. And also, he's a religious leader. Which begins to make a lot more sense once you look at Islam today, because it really does cover all of those three facets maybe well is not the right word, but it does. So Muhammad is going to fill all of the wells along the caravan route, and you can imagine that in the deserts of Saudi Arabia, if you're filling wells, it's pretty easy to kind of funnel people to one location that's going to have water, because they're going to have water at some point before they get to Mecca. And what he does is force the caravan to a position of his choice, where he wants to, of course, confront the armies of the caravan and the security forces, which is pretty intelligent to pick your own fighting ground and then figure out a way to entice a caravan to come into this area. That's a smart military move. Middle Eastern warfare is kind of unique. So you have an army of 300 Muslim immigrants and the Ansar, which are the converts to Islam that are from Medina. Okay, so not to use too many Arabian terms, but just to kind of give you an idea of what that 300 consists of. It's those from Mecca originally, but also the converts that he gains while he's in Medina. So he's only got 300, which most people believe he's not really planning on fighting a Meccan force of this size at the time. But the way that these battles begin is they pick three men, and they meet between the armies, and they fight. And then after that fight, the rest of the armies fight. So again, kind of odd, and I don't know necessarily what the result of that first fight among the six men, what that does for the rest of the groups. Maybe that just sort of fires them up to fight, and you know, if your three men are victorious, then you're a little bit more just excited to go to warfare. I would imagine that if your three men lose, then you're kind of like, well, I don't really know if I want to be next. But they're just following the traditional Middle Eastern warfare, and we think that that's silly, but you know, the French and the English used to march directly at each other in an open field, stand there in their brightly colored coats, and then, you know, from like 25 yards, point a musket and fire at each other. And you go, well, that's just as ridiculous. So, you know, it's the Americans that figured out warfare. We get credit for that. So with this confrontation, there's one interesting thing that I read. And I don't know exactly, the historical source didn't really expound on this story, but apparently after the fight between these six men, as these armies are charging at each other, Muhammad throws sand into the eyes of the Meccan soldiers, and it actually causes them to be in sort of disarray. And how close do you have to be to another army before you're actually throwing the sand? And if it's just one guy that's doing it, it's like, well, he kind of looks ridiculous because there's 1,000 guys, probably 995 soldiers that are just looking at the five guys. They're like, well, we'll probably just kill the guy that threw the sand, I guess. I don't know. But that sort of is a reflection of how difficult it is to study for this kind of thing, because you have legend and the religious aspects of it. So if you're studying a Muslim account of the battle, then it's going to be very closely intertwined with what they believe, you know, Allah is helping them to win the battle. And then it's like studying Greek history. It's mythology and actual historical events are so intertwined that it's really hard to figure out what exactly happened. So what we do know is that, you know, he has three times less the soldiers, and he comes out victorious. So that's going to be a very major development in establishing the Muslims not just as a political force in Medina and not just as a religious force, but as a military force. So now they actually have military leadership, and you have to begin to respect them as, you know, as a military unit. They seem to have some leadership, and they seem to be organized enough and disciplined enough that they can even defeat larger armies. Okay. So moving on to the Battle of Uhud, you have a military victory for the Meccans. They're able to kind of avenge themselves for this embarrassing defeat at Badr, but it's an unsuccessful attempt to capture Medina. So once again, depending on what account you read, it actually reads a little bit more like a victory for Muhammad. So, but military victories are so often just complicated because you think about the Civil War is notorious for battles where, you know, you have tens of thousands of soldiers that die on both sides, and then you say from a military standpoint, this army was forced off of the battlefield at the end, and so the other side won. But if you look at the death totals, you'll go, well, the Union Army lost way more than the Confederates did. How is it that they won? Well, it's not just up to numbers, and so if the goal of the attack at the Battle of Uhud is to displace Muhammad as leader of Medina, that didn't succeed. So were they successful from a military standpoint in like actually fighting one another? Did they force the Muslims off of the battlefield? Yes. Were they actually able to capture Medina and capture Muhammad? No. Okay. So a moral victory for the Muslims, a tactical victory for the Meccans. if that's one way that makes it a little bit easier to look at. Then we have this other battle that follows the Battle of Uhud, and that's the Battle of the Trench, which will become apparent as to why it's named that. So the Meccans actually march on the city proper of Medina in this sort of final organized effort to capture Muhammad and make sure that their caravans are no longer attacked. And what Muhammad does is dig these massive trenches around the most vulnerable parts of the city so that once again he gets to pick parts of the city that he has to defend, which are going to be the strongest fortified portions of the city. So again, a very intelligent military tactician to say, I know where my weaknesses are, but I'm actually going to turn those into my strengths because I'm going to force you to go the only route into the city. You're going to have to attack the my best portions of the wall. You're going to have to, I know exactly where you're going to have to attack, so I can put all my soldiers there. And I can defend this portion of the city and not really worry about you encircling around behind or anything like that. So usually what would happen here is you'd get into a siege situation where the attacking army would lay siege to the city and be able to basically starve them out. And that happens consistently with pretty much every major war. You get into a situation, you get to a fort, another fortified city, we have to take this city, so let's just wait it out. I don't know why it didn't work from a military standpoint for the Meccans to do that. My best guess is that since Medina itself was the oasis, if it was fortified enough that the Meccans did not have access to water, then a siege would actually be more like a siege against themselves as opposed to those that were in Medina. They have all the resources. They can be in there almost indefinitely, whereas the attacking army is sitting out there in the sand going, well, we can't attack the places that we thought we were able to attack, so they just turn around. And I don't know if there's some skirmishes that probably take place, but there's not this massive battle. They're just forced to turn back. They have to go to Mecca. So once again, we've got this pretty significant victory where the Meccans just time after time after time fail to accomplish that overall goal of let's remove Muhammad from leadership in Medina, let's get rid of these Muslim converts, and each time that Islam is not uprooted, the roots go deeper and deeper and deeper. Because now you go, wow, maybe this guy is actually onto something. Maybe he is blessed by Allah and he, has some insight into, our enemies that give him some sort of spiritual power. There's also another impact. It's not just the deeper roots of Islam with these military victories. It's also the continual impact on the Jewish tribes in Medina after each of these victories. So we have three victories, essentially, the Battle of Badr, the Battle of Uhud, and the Battle of the Trench. And there's three major Jewish tribes in Medina. And after each one, another Jewish tribe is removed from Medina, culminating in the last victory at the Battle of the Trench that Encyclopedia Britannica records for us. Once this last Jewish tribe is displaced, and that's the name of the tribe there, the Quraiza, all adult males are executed and the women and children are enslaved. Okay, so we kind of have this ultimate culmination of Muhammad's distaste and dislike for the Jewish tribes there, that they do not accept his religion, they do not accept him as a prophet within Judaism, and now he's removing them. The interesting thing that this book, A Concise History, records is that this particular treatment of the Jews, this is how they put it. These events did not poison later Muslim-Jewish relations, nor did Muhammad's policies cause what we now call the Arab-Israeli conflict. Okay. It also says neutralizing their enemies was essential to their security, if not survival. Okay. Now, because of the confrontations, and I'm still quoting, the Quran does contain some harsh words about the Jews. Okay. But the Jews were not defenseless. this was a situation that is viewed, at least by the historians that wrote this book, as something that would be more of a consolidation of power after a military conflict. Okay? Muhammad paints these Jewish tribes in a very negative light. He says that they were actually involved in helping the Meccans in this Battle of the Trench, that they were trying to find a way to aid them in some military capacity. And so that's his reasoning behind such this extreme reaction to this last Quraiza tribe. They don't provide any other really background for how it did not affect future Muslim-Jewish relations. I guess from my point of view, I don't know how it couldn't, because we also have lots of historical sources that say that basically at this time, everything that Muhammad is doing is being recorded in the Hadith and the other teaching, sort of the lifestyle manual of Islam. And yes. And so if Muhammad, and even this book states that he serves even today as the quintessential model Muslim. And so if he's the one that is displacing a Jewish tribe and executing adult males and selling women and children into slavery, then how does that not affect future relations with Jews? It seems like it would naturally poison in the minds of other Muslims, okay, Muhammad, our prophet, is doing this to this Jewish tribe. Now, it could be that the historians are saying, if you just look at it from a military standpoint, this is an enemy. It doesn't really matter whether or not they were Jewish or not. They could have been a Christian tribe. They could have been another pagan tribe. He would have done it anyway. Maybe that's the case. But it still remains to be seen, especially from our point of view, that there is a ton of conflict between the Arabs, the Muslims, and the Israelis, the Jews today. So how would that not have started all the way back during the Prophet Muhammad's time? And it's, again, it's not something that I have enough, I haven't done enough study into that topic specifically to say that this final, example of kicking out this Jewish tribe, that was the beginning of Muslim-Israeli hatred. I don't know that that's the case, but it certainly stands to reason that it could have at least contributed to what is ingrained in a lot of Muslims' minds, that you know, there's this eternal conflict between the two. Yes?
Well, you just have to look at today again. Okay, we've got the orthodoxy of the Jewish religion, the Orthodox Jews, that are actually in line with what Hamas is doing to Israel right now. And they're cheering.
So what's their reasoning behind that?
And it's the Orthodox Jews. It's not the Messianic Jews or the Zionist or... It's just the orthodoxy.
Yeah. Well, there's so many other factors that go into it that what we don't want to do is say that something that happened in 630 AD directly relates to the October 7th attack on Israel. Well, we can't make that type of claim, because Islam today looks totally different than it looked back then. Back during this time, not only is the Prophet Muhammad alive, but they're actually a very tightly knit, organized group, and Islam today is the exact opposite. It's fractured into a bunch of different belief systems, and even sometimes the different terrorist organizations don't even get along because they have different viewpoints of how to, you know, carry out different things. So, again, from a historical point of view, I can see why these historians may say that, but at the same time, it just stands to reason that, you know, if you have a conflict that is so bitter between two established religions, and one, of course, Judaism is much older than Islam, then, you know, if it's happening all the way back then, it kind of makes sense why it's happening today too. So, yes.
Say, you know, we
Yeah.
Communism. Mm-hmm. He's doing the same thing. I'm here as the next prophet for Judaism and Christianity, but I'm going to kill all the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that's funny that you say that, because that's what the historians also kind of say, that there's such a strange dichotomy between, and it's when he returns to Mecca. So all of these pagan people who actually fought him directly in military conflicts, they're all like the first in line to accept him as the prophet. But they're not Christians and Jews, and he thought that the Christians and Jews would be the ones that are like, oh yeah, like this is the next prophet, and we're going to accept everything that he says. And he got visions from the angel Gabriel, and we know who that is, and he knows Ibrahim, and he knows all of these other prophets. And it's the exact opposite. So these Arabs that have absolutely zero background in Abrahamic religion, they all line up like crazy to be his converts, especially after this happens, this return to Mecca. But the Christians and Jews are like, absolutely not. You're not going to get hardly any converts out of our religions. You know, we think you're off your rocker. We think that, you know, it's blasphemous for you to suggest that you're a continued revelation of what we've already received. So it is kind of odd. We do have a truce that is going to be signed before the return to Mecca, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce that Arabic word. This ends the organized warfare between Muslims and the Meccans. It's not really all that exciting. It's not like there's this massive war, and then the Meccans are forced to sign a peace treaty. It's essentially like, hey, let's just meet. We know that the stuff that we're doing to you is not great, and the stuff that you're doing to us is not great, so let's just call it off. It works for about 2 years. So the truce is signed in 628, and by 630, Muhammad is claiming that the other tribes that signed this cease of hostilities, they've actually broken the terms of it. And so he gathers, and this is a crazy sized army for back in 630 AD. He gathers 10,000 soldiers to march on Mecca as a result of his belief that they've broken this truce. And of course, the Arabs in Mecca are just absolutely awestruck. Like, this is quite the homecoming. Okay, this guy that left with just a handful of converts to Medina and was just raiding caravans, now he's got 10,000 soldiers under his command and some of the best warriors in the Saudi Peninsula. They've converted to Islam, and there's no fighting. It's a bloodless coup. He marches on Mecca. They're like, yeah, we can't really do anything about an army this size. You're obviously a very influential person. Whatever you've got going on, we want to be a part of, and so forth. So there's a lot of submission to Muhammad and his teaching. And most of the Meccans, most of those that live in the city, will convert to Islam right away. Probably by force. They're going to be forced to convert. But also maybe just by the simple standpoint of, you know, you're standing at the walls of the city of Mecca, and you're seeing this massive force of Muslims. You're like, yeah, I'd kind of rather be a part of that than whatever army I'm a part of that's about to defend against an army this size. It's kind of like the 8-year-old that's raised as a, you know, Broncos fan, but oh, the Chiefs are really good this year, so I like the Chiefs. And then you've got to have a conversation with them that we don't like the Chiefs, we don't cheer for them, but you know, they're gonna convert, and it's really not much of a, there's no fighting that's put up by the Meccans. So again, we're kind of robbed of this sort of ultimate battle between the powerful Meccans and their pagan religion and the newly powerful Muhammad. Like, how great would that conflict have been? And we get to, you know, study the different military tactics that are used, and it's like, nope. He just marched in, and they're like, yeah, okay, sounds good.
Did MacArthur say the same thing about Japan, though? Since we conquered Japan so easily, well, not so easily, you moved their weapons, but they were so humble and submissive. I heard that he called for every missionary that could come because the Japanese were in a position of submission. They knew their God was a great enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. There was just tons of, well, the Japanese they were such a proud people, and they were humiliated in such a, on the world stage, you get these, the most technologically advanced weapon ever developed, and you get two of those bombs dropped on your country. That's going to be pretty humbling. They actually followed a basically military religion where, Hirohito was exalted as a god, and so all of that, it comes crumbling down. So I could see, that, and probably sort of the same here, where it's just sort of that, we've been humiliated by this person that we were persecuting just a few years ago, and now we've just gotten to the point where we're so broken down over these battles that we've lost, and now here he comes with 10,000 soldiers, and so it's just kind of an easy psychological, there is no psychological warfare. Like, the Meccans can't psychologically stand against somebody who has that much influence, and he's probably carrying himself in such a way that he's, inspiring as a leader and so forth. So, yeah, I don't know that there was a lot of open resistance to being converted to Islam. Janet?
Just curious, you talked about the tenets of Islam.
Mm-hmm, the five pillars?
Yeah. Would that have been, when they say they converted, is it just like, okay, I believe in Allah?
Well, yeah, so I don't know if I'll do this next week or the week after, but I'm going to talk about how you actually convert to Islam, and I actually was able to see a video of basically what we would consider a revival meeting, I think it was in Australia, for Islam, and there was an imam there that was from New York, and there are people that come forward at the end of the sermon to convert to Islam, and I'll show you guys that video because it's kind of interesting, the similarities. But basically what you have to do is you just have to recite the following, but you have to recite it in Arabic, La ilaha il Allah, Muhammad Rasul Allah, which is there is no God whatever, but the one God, Muhammad is the messenger of God. And at that point, you are a Muslim.
So that's all
I have to do. So, yes, that is the point of conversion. So much like similar to different religions where there is just, now you're converted. Like, now you are identified with this religion. It's the same with Islam. Now, the other five pillars, those are how you live out the Muslim faith, and you do have to, carry out those works to be considered, and it could have happened over the course of a few days that you have all of these conversions. My wife was laughing at me because I just said it in Arabic. But I actually heard, and I'm going to have to look this up before I teach on that topic, but I've heard that the Muslims actually don't even believe that you have to believe it when you say it, that as long as you say it, you're actually still converted. So just realize that. Darn.
There's
a lot of Christians that believe the same thing. But now, see that, my wife's been baptized in the Catholic Church. When she was just a baby, she has one of her bases covered, and now I have one of mine. Aren't we glad that it doesn't work like that? You just got to go from religion to religion. Okay, well, if this one's right, then I'm good. I got married in the Mormon Church, and I got baptized a Catholic, and I, said the Lord's Prayer, and just on and on and on. That would be terrible. The Meccans are now Muslims. So he continues to consolidate power. He's only got 2 years left to live at this point. 630 AD is when he marches on Mecca, and then he dies in 632. He actually stays in Medina and uses that as the capital of his new growing empire almost, and begins to force other tribes in the area to accept Islam, and so it begins to spread on the Arabian Peninsula there, and then they even pay taxes, which is something that his tribe within the Quraysh tribe has never been able to impose before. So he's sort of exalted his own tribe up to a position of leadership that they've never had, and now they're going to the other Arab tribes and making them do obeisance, which is a pretty interesting development and a long history of tribal Arabs. So now he is he's approaching death, and there's a lot of things that are going to happen that sort of throw Islam into a long history of confusion, and they're not going to be nearly as organized. You can just kind of imagine that if you have people that are following you so devoutly, and then you just remove this military, political, religious leader, and he's gone, who is going to fill that power vacuum? And that is what leads to all of the separations between the different sects of Islam, and it's kind of interesting how it fractures into so many different places and yet is able to still unify to the point where you have the spread of the Muslim Empire throughout Africa and north into Israel, Turkey, Spain, and even southern France at some points. So how do we get to that point? So Muhammad is an interesting historical character because of all of these different roles that he holds. He founds a religion, which is one of the largest religions today. He's a major military leader. He's a major political leader. And this is what Goldschmidt Jr. and Davidson have to say about him in A Concise History of the Middle East. How do we evaluate Muhammad and what he did? For Muslims, he has always been the exemplar of Muslim virtues such as piety, patience, humor, kindness, generosity, and sobriety. Non-Muslim Westerners, like ourselves, recalling Christian battles and disputations with Islam, have often judged him harshly. These different assessments remind us that observant Jews and sincere Christians do not believe, as Muslims must, that Muhammad was to obey God's commands as revealed to him by the angel Gabriel. And we would agree with that from the point that as Christians, we don't believe that Muhammad is a prophet, and we don't really follow any of his teachings on any subject, certainly not when it pertains to our scripture. So he calls us people of the book, challenges us to read his revelations, and we read those and say there's too many contradictions. Now, I think Goldschmidt and Davidson are trying to be as objective as possible, which is always the goal of a historian. They're not trying to take the Christian point of view. They're also not trying to take the Muslim point of view. They're trying to find some middle ground. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, if you just kind of leave it up to the person that's reading your historical account, then you really haven't made the most difficult analysis of your historical facts, which is, okay, so what does it mean? Okay. There are a lot of Muslims in the world today, but certainly there has to be a way for us to evaluate Muhammad from an objective standpoint to say he was all this or all that, or, you know, some of the things that he did was good and some of the things that he did was bad, but how do we analyze that? I hate it when historians do this. Okay, well, I'll just leave it up to you. Well, no, you're the person that by writing this book has said, I am at least, you know, better versed in whatever I'm writing about than you are. Okay, so give me your analysis. Whether or not I agree with it doesn't matter. But at least, you know, be able to stand on something and say, I don't think that Muhammad was, you know, good at whatever. So we have to do this ourselves, which is fine. And we're going to do it from our standpoint, right? Because we're in Sunday school, so of course we're going to analyze him as Christians, as we should. This is kind of an aside. I don't have any content on what I'm about to say on the slides, but over the past week I've been thinking about this because I do appreciate objective historians that do not try to, you know, allow any bias into how they record history. They're just looking for this event happened, this person lived from this date to this date, this is what they did. And they're not necessarily trying to cast they're not moral judges as to how someone acted historically. So it's very, very dangerous for us in 2024 to look back on really any point in history and say this person was a bad person because they did this, and so everything that they did was bad. And that's what we see happening with Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, and we just, you know, they made one mistake in their life, or there's one thing about their lives that I personally disagree with, and so we just throw the baby out with the bathwater. They're bad people historically. Well, who are you to cast judgment on them from your culture today? Because if you were raised in the same culture and in the same time as them, you would have been 100 times worse than they were within that exact culture, right? And I just, it just strikes me as so incredibly proud and presumptuous is a great word, for you to think that you are the moral judge for people who have lived at other points in history. There is one judge. Believe me, those people will be judged for their actions. It's not for us to start pointing fingers to people that live, because I told my students during COVID, I said, I guarantee you in a couple years, you know, and this was in like the spring of 2020, I said, in a couple years, what's going to happen? Either everyone is going to say how stupid those people during COVID were because they quarantined and wore masks and they took this vaccine and it wasn't even that big of a deal. Or they're going to say how stupid those people during COVID were because all they did was take a vaccine and wear masks and social distance and they didn't realize how deadly this thing was. It's like, well, no, of course we didn't. We didn't know any of those things because we lived at this point in history. You know, we didn't have all the information yet. So it could have been the most deadly pandemic ever, or it could have been nothing. And yet all of the people 5 years from now, you know, your kids, you know, I was talking to my high schoolers, your kids are going to look at you and go, man, you guys were dumb. Why'd you do that? Okay, well, I didn't have the benefit of being educated 20 years in the future. You know, that's why I may seem, you know, uneducated. But as far as non-bias analysis goes, what is objective truth as opposed to subjective truth?
Whether they're good or whether they're bad.
Yep.
They're part of our back.
Yep.
And how our country was formed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're for us to learn from. Okay. But if you think about objective truth, what is the ultimate objective source of truth? Right? And so we start our objectivity when it comes to analyzing something from a point where people would say you're being subjective. And I got to thinking about that. I'm teaching on a historical subject from a point of view of somebody who's studied things from an objective standpoint. What's the most objective standpoint I could have? How would God judge this person? Because that is objective truth. There has to be a source of truth. Because if you just look at something and say, we're just going to analyze it objectively, you could go in 4 million different directions. Because the source of objectivity, it has to start somewhere. There's got to be a single point where we say, you know, now we can go on this path and say, this is right and this is wrong. Okay? So from a historical perspective, I think, you know, even personally, I have to remember that I'm not removing my religious beliefs when I'm studying this. I have to make sure that even, and we all have to as we go through this topic, have to make sure that we actually are being objective. And by being objective, that means we're in tune with God's word and how God analyzes history and says, this is bad and this is good. Because everyone's going to be held to the same standard. We all believe that. There's no differentiation with God. He's not going to judge the Prophet Muhammad differently than he judges any of us. And he's not going to judge George Washington and Thomas Jefferson any differently than he judges the three most recent presidents of the United States, right? Because otherwise that wouldn't be objective. Then he would be a respecter of persons, and we know biblically that's not the case. Okay? So to be objective, we have to allow ourselves to see things, we have to know God. That really is the ultimate lesson, because otherwise you will be doing things subjective. And these types of historians that are like, we're going to throw out Christian tradition and values, and we're going to throw out Muslim tradition and values, and we're just going to be objective. Atheism is not objective. And I think the sooner that, well, our society is probably too far gone to realize that, but we've just come to the belief that if you look at things from an atheist standpoint, that's the most objective thing that you can do. And it's simply not the case. It's not. Because atheists believe in an infinite amount of rights and wrongs because there is no guide for them that tells them whether one thing's right or wrong. So that's just my little aside, and it took up the rest of my Sunday school time. I will go ahead and just, I can probably take one or two questions before we end. And we'll go over a little bit more about the death of Muhammad next week.